Annähernd 50% der Stellenbesetzungen auf Management-Level stellen sich als eine Fehlbesetzung innerhalb der ersten 18 Monate nach Einstieg der Person heraus. Treue Zuhörer kennen diese Quote bereits aus der Episode 65 dieses Podcasts, in der ich die durchschnittlichen Kosten einer Fehlbesetzung im Management aus der aktuellen Studienlage abgeleitet habe. Das Interessante dabei, in allen gemessenen Fällen basierend auf einer Stichprobe von 20.000 Messungen, na, da waren Headhunter beteiligt. Es bietet sich daher an, aufgrund auch meines Berufsstandes, sich mal mit dem Thema Executive Search auseinanderzusetzen. Heute möchte ich Ihnen keine konkreten Karrieretipps geben oder den verdeckten Arbeitsmarkt für Sie beleuchten, sondern einen Einblick in den Executive Search-Markt auf einer Metaebene gewähren. Denn wir sprechen über die Entwicklung des Executive Searchs. Wenn ich sage wir, meine ich, dass ich mir Verstärkung geholt habe. Es handelt sich erstmalig um ein Interview, das wir auf Englisch führen werden, denn der CEO von Mercury-Urval, Richard Moore, wird uns die historische Entwicklung des Executive Searchs erzählen, sowie Einblicke in unsere Zunft zur Verfügung stellen, was ja indirekt für Sie und Ihre Karriere wertvolle Insights bedeuten kann. Es wird kein englischer Podcast aus dem CEO Career Code werden, aber Richard Moore kommt aus UK und seine strategische Perspektive auf den Executive Search Markt ist global kaum zu übertreffen. Lassen Sie uns loslegen.
Herzlich willkommen beim CEO Career Code, dem Karriere-Podcast mit Inspiration und Insiderwissen für Top-Manager und jene, die es werden wollen. Präsentiert von Ihrem Headhunter Dominik Roth.
So, welcome Richard Moore to the CEO Career Code Podcast.
Thanks, Dominik. Nice to be here.
Really looking forward to it. It is the first time we are producing an episode in English on this channel. Today, we want to give our listeners insight into the development of the executive search market, starting with its traditional roots, which we now refer to as headhunting in its baby steps, moving through its various stages of evolution and concluding with the current landscape and nowadays industry standards. We won't turn this into a Mercury-Urval pitch, but rather aim to present the history and demands of our industry as objectively as possible. The insights also reflect the common understanding shared by our market participants, a consensus we can all agree on. And who would be better suited than you to guide us through this meta-level perspective? Okay, so if we go back in time, when were the first headhunting activities documented and how was headhunting actually conducted back in those days?
Yeah, great question. I think the very origins of the industry, you have to go back to the latter part of the second industrial revolution. As things started to change and organizations started to evolve, so we're talking late 20th century, then you found companies that we know still today well, like McKinsey, Booz Allen, starting to get into headhunting. At this time, there wasn't specific executive search firms. It was rather something that was a kind of branch of management consulting professional services. And you really have to wind the clock forward all the way to the sort of 1950s before you start to really see dedicated executive search firms, mostly starting in the US.
Mm-hmm. And how was it about? Was it based on my address book? Here, pick some contacts out of it and I will recommend them to you?
Yeah, well, of course, these two periods in world history were characterized by a lot of industrial and economic change. So you had organizations needing new requirements and new kinds of people. I think the start of the headhunter, as in some ways it still is today, was the well-connected individual that knew people. My saying, at least for the industry, really is Rolodexes and resumes. You remember the old manual card system, the Rolodex with different people's names on it, and then resumes, people's CVs, and the diplomatic and connected individual would pass these names and relevant CVs to people looking for new employees at senior level, and soon realized that they could get paid quite handsomely for the task, so they shouldn't do it for free. And there you've got the kind of commercialization of the industry, which really kicked on in the 1950s, 60s and 70s as these firms started to grow.
I'm really surprised it started that early. And does the same apply to Europe?
Yeah, I think I mean, if you look at a company like ours, so we're one of the longest running in the industry. So we were founded in 1967, and the work started a little bit before that. I think what's interesting, if you compare ourselves from a sort of Nordics, Northern European context, is the Rolodex and resume start place for the industry is completely different to our start place. We actually started running experiments into predicting if people could do a job they'd never done before. So rather than the finding side of things, it was rather the selection side of things. And you do, I think, can see the roots of this in the difference between perhaps the model that developed in continental Europe a little bit later and the US-UK model that was perhaps 20, 30 years before that, and much more focused on that magic Rolodex of business contacts.
Mm-hmm. So we were back in those days already the scientific, I would say, counterparts to the US, right?
Yeah, I think the clue's in the name, as you often say, and I mean, Mercury, for those that don't know, is coming from the god of commerce, business, and Urval, which I still cannot pronounce properly, is a Swedish word, means selection in Swedish. So taken literally, the company's name was business selection, and the idea was that you could make a prediction if you followed a certain method whether someone could do a job they'd never had before. And contrasted with the other idea, which became the dominant idea, that if you could find people that had done a similar job before that had a relevant resume, they would probably do a good job of a similar type of role in a new company. I think mm-hmm. these days we know that not really to be the case, but certainly that's what powered the industry in the first 30 or 40 years of its global development.
Mm-hmm. And when did this exclusive and retain contracts started?
Yeah, so I mean, again, it's hard to put a sort of exact date on that, but I think you're looking around that 1950s, 1960s time. You've got the birth of what is today the largest industry body for the search industry, which is the Association of Executive Search and Leadership Consultants. I think that started like 1959. Mm-hmm. Around there, and that certainly was with a mandate to increase professional standards, that the work should meet certain criteria of professionalism and ethical standards, and that the work should be retained. And then you started to get this distinction away from the contingent recruiter way of working. And I think it's from really that moment on. So basically coming into the 1960s and 70s, you start to see that happen.
Mm-hmm. If I the bad cop in this conversation, I would say that a lot of headhunters are still working like in the 1950s, yeah, based on the network recommending profiles and CVs. So it's still a really good business, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the truth is, and there's quite a few articles. There's one not too long ago in The Economist digging into the industry. I think in some ways, everything has changed and nothing has changed. So the technology revolutionized the Rolodex, but essentially a modern database that many search firms still use is not that different. It's a restricted talent pool of known connections. And even something like LinkedIn or Zing, which is understood to have so many people in it, is still restricted. There's more men, for example, than women of a professional age on it, and the way people update it affects their profile. So today, as years ago, you still have this diversity problem, meaning that certain candidates are not included because they're not part of the club. They're not in the databases. They're not in easy to find, and therefore they're often not found. The second thing, which hasn't changed so much, is the effectiveness of the conventional method. In recent times, there's been a lot of studies done by research scientists, including one notable Nobel Prize winner who wrote a book about it, looking at prediction accuracy in a recruitment. And despite the use of more modern techniques and technologies, the selection accuracy hasn't really improved either in the last 70 years. So the chance of a leader being recruited and being successful is still not much better than a coin flip. So it's a 50 to 60% probability of success. I mean, that's also, of course, because it's very difficult to predict if someone could do a job they've never had before and an environment they've never had before. So a lot has changed. I think a lot has changed about the way the companies present themselves. The industry has gone totally global. It's gone from a few million to more than $25 billion, is the recent estimates. But at its heart, the conventional method, at least, still has these two challenges, what I would call the diversity problem and the performance problem. And a lot more work is required in the industry to truly overcome them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before we dig into details regarding those two challenges or problem, how you call them, it is not so long ago that also some executive search renowned headhunters were not willing to present some long lists or do even research. Yeah. I have a story like that because I met one of our first German headhunters. He's really, really renowned from Munich. I can reveal his name, Dieter Rickert. And I met him in the year he retired, and he was quite honest towards me. And he told me that he's tired of being asked, can you do the research? Do you have some more candidates than the only one you recommend here? And he was quite affected by this question, like, do you doubt my recommendation? How dare you asking me this question? And the other thing is, what is this assessment topic about, Dominic? He asked me. The assessment is my stomach feeling, isn't it? Yeah, don't they trust me? So it's not so long ago, and he was like in 2005 to 2010, there were a lot of articles about him and his work. So it is not so long ago that we talk about research and holistic approach, about assessments, etc. And what I tell clients always is the same. Only because I know someone, it doesn't mean that this candidate is the best match for your certain situation. Yeah, it's the only advantage that I know him or her. Yeah, and maybe that is something that we can a little bit reveal, not from our MU perspective, but from the scientific perspective. What does science say about this kind of work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, of course, interesting topic, and it's at the heart, even more than how has the industry developed, but what will be the industry's future? Because I think the client, understandably, is much better informed and much better educated. And they know what we have known for years, which is it is actually possible to significantly increase the chances of a successful recruitment if you follow certain methods that scientists and researchers have studied, to be honest, for as long as the industry has existed. I mean, for more than 70 years, it's been known that a traditional unstructured interview or the random chance of someone being in someone's network is not a consistently reliable way to choose the right person to run a company. What's interesting is we haven't applied that. And you mentioned something which made me smile. You talked about this person who I don't know talking about their
really legend. I like him, and he's renowned here in Germany. Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. But the science is not on his side. I mean, the simple advice you could give to any person making a leadership selection is don't trust your gut. Mm-hmm. The much better thing to do is to go through a step-by-step procedure, evaluating different aspects of a person in the right order. And if you do that, then you have a much higher chance of making a successful executive search decision. What we've learned in executive search, if it's done properly with a high accuracy, is it's not that different to choosing a new car. You need to do it step by step. If you're a family with three kids and two partners, the first thing you're going to look for is, of course, a car with five seats. You might also like to get a black car, but nobody's just looking for black cars. They're only looking for cars with five seats. And only when you've got cars with five seats would you then start to look at the color of them. It's exactly the same in recruitment. You have to follow a logical sequence if you want to end up with the thing that you want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even though this person knows the industry, knows the sector, has the right track record, maybe in turnaround management, maybe in scaling business. So it is quite common that in the PE environment, I love that environment because it has a quiet pace in its processes. So that is the, I would say the focus on the pre-selection. How about that? Why isn't that enough if we just have someone who is from the same sector and has the right track record?
Yeah, I think at the heart of this is context. The context in which the person performs needs to be understood just as well or even better than the person themselves. So there's a double assessment that's required to be accurate in order to make a good prediction of a leader that will perform longer term. One thing is to know that individual effectively and objectively. And the other is to properly understand both in the short term and the longer term what tasks and responsibilities they should perform well in. And they're always unique. It doesn't matter if you're in the same sector. Each organization has a unique context. Each organization has a unique environment. And therefore, each leader should be assessed afresh if they should fit in, match, and be able to influence in that environment rather than to make what I would call a shortcutting. A lazy assumption that because this person's worked in this sector before, they'll probably be able to do it again. There's simply no evidence to support that's true.
But everyone is working like that. And also part of our process is aligned to track record interviewing, etc. But the missing link seems to be evaluating also the context in order to avoid the performance problem of the coin flip of the 50% I revealed in the introduction of this podcast episode. So, and the other topic is in Germany, like a real political, it sounds political, especially if we say inclusion and diversity. But what we mean by inclusion in the executive search context is not that we're talking about including handicapped people. That's the wrong translation in German. It is more about being inclusive in the research to not exclude candidates because of certain aspects of their of their personality, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you made some really good comments there. Firstly, let me go back to something you said at the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, sector is not the same as track record. Track record is extremely important to assess, but it's track record at performing tasks. Has the person conducted a successful M&A? Has the person led a business through growth? And they may or may not have done that in a particular industry sector. The industry sector they've done it in is relevant, but it's simply not sufficient in order to make an effective assessment. And the basic rule of thumb for people, and whether people are working with us or they're doing their own recruitment selection decisions you should follow, is the first thing you should look at is what someone has done. And you should include only people that have done things relevant to what you need to be done. Experience. The second thing you need to look at is, having got that experience, has the individual got the right knowledge and skills relevant to the role that they need to perform? It's not the same as experience, but it's closely linked to it. The third thing you need to look at is the individual's behavior and how will they work within the role. So here we get into personal characteristics, personality, cognitive abilities. And what's super important if you want to make an accurate recruitment is to do these things in a simple way, step by step. So back to your inclusion question, the first thing you should do is include people based on facts that have relevant experience. The second thing you should do is remove from that group of people those that don't have the relevant knowledge and skills. So that's your first selection. And the second selection, the final one, should be to remove those that won't have the right behaviors and impact in the organization they're going to work in. And when you do that, you'll end up with the one or two candidates that will be able to perform well in the role. And that should be the basis for the prediction. So it's not that necessarily colleagues like the one you referred to are doing the wrong thing, but they were only looking at part of the decision-making process. And if you'd like to make a more accurate prediction, you should look at more things. The final thing I want to comment, and it's really important from a selection science perspective, is back to this inclusion thing. And exactly as you say, this is using the concept of including people with plausible, relevant knowledge, experience, and skills. and it stands to reason if you look at it like this, but just imagine a funnel. Clearly, you're going to get a more accurate chance for a prediction out the end of your funnel if you include more relevant, plausible people in the top. So diversity and inclusion is, from a selection science perspective, it's not the purpose, but it's part of achieving the purpose. The purpose being to hire the person who will perform best in the role.
Yeah, but that's really important what you said. It's not the purpose. It's not a political purpose in the first instance. It's more like getting to this, to the solution in a real better way. And maybe that's really important. And what I observed in our industry when I started, it was like everyone had an assessment back in those days, but it was like everyone bought an assessment, etc. So when was the first documentation of, okay, track record and sector specific know-how is not sufficient, we need also this personality aspects. When was that like the trend in our industry?
Yeah, well, I think as a trend, you're probably looking not more than 20 years ago. And then, of course, you've got our company, Mercurio, being the odd one out because we started with that. So our founder was looking at that in the 1960s in his university study. So as a science, it's not that new. He was certainly not the only one or the first one looking at that. But to apply it to the recruitment of executives, that really didn't catch on. Until the 21st century, basically. And I think It's also important because words get thrown around. What is an assessment? Actually, today, there's three really types of assessment going on, if we talk about that. There's what I would call a cutoff assessment. You're listening to this, I'm sure, will be familiar with these. You'll have heard of them. They're commonly found in organizations looking to recruit a large number of people. And they're typically using raw psychometric test tools to say that anyone who doesn't meet this cognitive level on the test or anyone that doesn't have this typology of personality, they're out. Not very common used in executive search, but some organizations have experimented with them. The second type of assessment, and this is by far the most common, is I think most appropriately called a descriptive assessment. The purpose of this is to describe the individual's personal qualities, work style, thinking style, typically against a standardized model, in order that the decision maker has more information. Interestingly, this doesn't do any use to help the accuracy of the selection decision. A lot of this information, whilst interesting, is probably not relevant to job performance. And there's nothing in this typical assessment that most search firms use that would help you with a prediction. The third type of assessment is a predictive assessment. A predictive assessment has a specific purpose to increase the probability of a correct decision, whether someone can perform in a certain job. These assessments are more involved. They need more certified delivery standards, and they need a different setup in terms of the tools and method. They're very rare. And those assessments are very, very unusual in the industry still, but I would expect in the future we'll see much more of them.
Mm, okay, let's see. Let's follow your prediction. And thank you for the nerd talk so far. I hope the listeners could derive some really good insights from that, because it's about the evolution, first starting with the book of candidates, of contacts, going through research. And now we know also why it is important research to include also candidates that I don't know will be maybe better for the job. And it's a stepwise process where also personality should be taken into account based on an assessment that you just revealed. So let's have a look if you're right with your prediction. Thank you for the summary of the history and of this evolution. So thank you for that, Richard.
Thanks a lot, Dominic. Nice to see you.
Wenn Ihnen als Zuhörer, Zuhörerin diese Interviews eine Inspiration sind, beziehungsweise Sie aus meinen Episoden ohne Interviewpartner einen wahren Mehrwert für Ihre Karriere beziehen, freue ich mich, wenn Sie den Podcast abonnieren, um zukünftige Inhalte nicht zu verpassen. Treten Sie auch gerne in Kontakt mit mir, falls Sie im Unternehmen bei der Suche und Auswahl nach geeigneten Führungskräften Unterstützung suchen oder Sie sich als Führungskraft selbst in der Neuorientierung befinden, also zum Beispiel den nächsten Job antreten möchten oder ein Aufsichtsrats- bzw. Beiratsmandat anstreben. Sehen Sie hierzu mal in die Shownotes dieser Folge, denn dort finden Sie die entsprechenden Kontaktmöglichkeiten je nach Bedarf. Dort finden Sie auch eine kostenfreie Video-Fallstudie verlinkt mit ersten Tipps für Ihre Neuorientierung. In jedem Fall rate ich Ihnen dazu, den Podcast zu abonnieren, wie gesagt, denn wir beleuchten Karriere weiterhin auf einer ganzheitlichen Ebene. Ich freue mich auf die nächsten Episoden mit Ihnen, Ihr Dominik Roth.